This is the second in a series of interviews with Bishop Richard Williamson, rector of St. Thomas Aquinas Seminary, about doctrine. And in this interview, we'll try to gain a better understanding of Pope John Paul II. And let's begin by asking, why is it that some observers of this pope find many of his actions and policies confusing?
I think they're confusing because I think the present pope, John Paul II, is trying to reconcile inside his head and inside his ideas and inside his actions two systems which can't really be reconciled. And so as he tries to fit together two things that can't be fit together, some people see the one side of it, some people see the other side, and some people read it one way, some people read it the other, and it's just a constant to and fro, because he will say one thing and he'll say the opposite of it, and then some people take the one thing and some people take the opposite, and so it's confusion.
Now let's try to gain a handle on this Pope's thinking. Has Vatican II had a major impact on the thinking of John Paul II?
Without any doubt at all. He himself took part in Vatican II as a bishop. He was a young bishop at the time, or for bishops he was a young man at the time, I think in his 40s, perhaps even his late 30s. In any case, he's no older than his 40s, I'm sure. And he was one of the bright lights of the Vatican. He took a leading part in drawing up one of the key documents of the Vatican II, which was Gaudium et Spes. He was an absolute believer, a complete and absolute believer in Vatican II. He believed everything it was trying to do, everything that it represented. He absolutely believed in this updating of the old church. And he has believed in it ever since. If there's one thing he really believes in, I would say it's that Second Vatican Council, because for him it represented the ideal of blending Catholic tradition, the Catholic, with the modern world. And in his view, the Catholic Church is that blend of Catholic tradition with the modern world. And I'm sure he is convinced that he is both faithful to Catholic tradition and reaching out to the modern world.
Now, how can the Pope continue to praise Vatican II in the face of the continuing collapse of the Church that has occurred since then?
I think in two ways. My guess is in two ways. One, I don't think he sees everything that you and I might see as collapse as collapse. I think he is blind to a great deal of the destruction that goes on, or he thinks that it really is advancing rather than destruction. Two, he's persuaded, like so many Vatican IIists or conciliar Catholics, he's persuaded that the Council has been misapplied. In other words, he doesn't see damage, or he denies damage, or he thinks that damage is not the result of the Second Vatican Council. In any case, he is absolutely convinced of the complete necessity of guiding the Church in the light of the principles of Vatican II, which are the blend of old-fashioned Catholicism with modern ideals.
So he wouldn't attribute, let's say, the collapse in the numbers of seminarians or churchgoers to Vatican II itself?
I don't think so. No, I'm sure he wouldn't. He would say that people are not understanding the Council, that people are misapplying the Council, that they've gone altogether too far, that's not what the Council meant. He himself, in his own being, is a rebel who maintains the rebellion at a certain point, so to speak. But what he, like so many rebels, doesn't realize is that rebellions have a way of sweeping forward on their own. And therefore you can't launch a rebellion and then stop it at a certain point. Once you launch it, it has a momentum of its own. And that's what I think he, like many decent rebels, if you can call them that, I think he doesn't understand that. There, at the time of the French Revolution, you had your moderate revolutions, the Girondins, and your radical revolutions, the Jacobins. And the Girondins were decent men, but they were just swept away by the Jacobins. And I think that's what's happened to him.
Now, is the area of philosophy of any importance? Because I'd like to go into here some of the philosophic foundations of his thinking.
The area of philosophy is enormously important because, one, philosophy is always important for everybody, because every man must have some philosophy. We were saying in the first tape, all action is governed by ideas, and a man's philosophical ideas are his deepest ideas. A man may think he has no philosophy at all, but in fact, every single man has a philosophy, namely, a deep and broad set of ideas by which he deeply and broadly sets his life. So in that sense, every man has a philosophy, and in that sense, in that broad sense, the philosophy of every man is the deepest and broadest clue and light as to what he thinks and why he does what he does. Secondly, in the case of John Paul II in particular, he is a professional philosopher, and he's a philosopher by inclination and by background, by time spent on it, by the books he's written. He takes himself to be a philosopher, and therefore he takes philosophy seriously, and he acts on what he has worked out to be his philosophy, and therefore philosophy is always important, but particularly important for a man like John Paul II.
Now, the strongest strand of traditional church philosophy has been Thomism. Very briefly, what is Thomism, and would you consider Pope John Paul II to be a Thomist?
Two questions. Firstly, what is Thomism? Thomism is the glorious common sense philosophy evolved by St. Thomas Aquinas, which is why it's called Thomism, on the basis of the great Greek philosopher Aristotle, who, profiting by 300 years of mistakes of his predecessors, finally worked out a complicated, magnificent system of thinking which really accounts for the world as it is. Aristotle recognized the way reality is. He didn't try to tell reality what it was. He simply analyzed it as it is and got down the main divisions and principles to explain reality as it is. St. Thomas Aquinas followed Aristotle and blended that together with the faith in a superb combination of natural truth and supernatural truth, which has been the Church's great fortress of thinking ever since. That's Thomism. Secondly, is Pope John Paul II a Thomist? Answer, basically, no, for a very simple reason. He studied St. Thomas when in his theological training in Rome in the late 40s, I think. He even studied under the great Dominican theologian Garrigou Lagrange. But he had already studied existentialism and personalism. He had studied the modern systems. And he thought that when he studied Thomism alongside the modern systems, and when he thought that he was believing in Thomism alongside believing in the modern systems, he thought that he was really believing in Thomism just as much as he was believing in the modern systems. What he, I believe, did not understand then, or at any point since, is that Thomism is not a system that you believe in alongside and to complement and to perfect other systems. If Thomism contradicts any other system on any point, or if any other system contradicts Thomism, then you cannot believe both. Now, modern systems are absolutely incompatible with Thomism because, whereas Thomism submits to the object, my mind puts itself under the object. This is the way reality is, and my mind accepts it as it is. That's Thomism, that's common sense, that's the way people live 24 hours a day.
So St. Thomas was a realist?
Yes. You know, that real comes from the Latin res, which means thing. He was a thing man. In other words, things are like that. This is how things are. My mind submits to things. My mind recognizes things. My mind admits things as they are. Now, modern philosophy is not realist. Modern philosophy is more or less idealist. In other words, my ideas are king of reality. For the Thomist, for a man of common sense, for the Aristotelian, for anybody who's got any sense of reality, the thing is the king of my ideas. But for moderns, my ideas are the king of things. So things are how I say they are. Things are to be analyzed how I say they're to be analyzed. Things have to come in front of the judgment seat of my mind and beg for acceptance. And if I accept and consent to them, well, that's lucky for them. But if I don't accept and consent them, then they are ruled out of court. And I am the king of reality.
But this is a very man-centered type of philosophy, which would go along then with what we said in the previous interview about how the church has shifted in its focus from God to man.
Exactly. Ever since the Renaissance and the Reformation, man has been putting himself more at the center. And as man put himself at the center, it was inevitable that he would put himself in the center in philosophy as well. The philosopher who really put the finishing touches to this man-centeredness in thinking was the German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who died around 1810. And Pope Pius X, Pope St. Pius X, who died in 1914, who was Pope from 1903 to 1914, said Kantism is the modern heresy. In other words, the problem with modern people's minds, modern Catholics' minds, is that they're infected with Kant. In other words, Catholics, instead of thinking like St. Thomas, that reality is the king of my mind, they're thinking like Kant, my mind is the king of reality.
So taking to, let's say, its logical conclusion, a modern philosopher, if, let's say, he thought that he was King Henry, then that would be the reality, because he thinks that is so.
Yes. Now, of course, modern philosophers are not quite as dumb as that. They're selective where they are crazy. I mean, they choose where to be crazy and where not to be crazy. When it comes to recognizing whether coffee is coffee on the breakfast table, they recognize that coffee is coffee, because if they didn't, they'd get thirsty. They recognize bread is bread, they recognize the car is the car, otherwise they wouldn't get to the office. But then when they get to their philosophy office or their study and get into their study, then they deliberately choose not to recognize the reality of God, the reality of Jesus Christ, the reality of the Catholic Church. Then in their philosophy study, they set up some crazy system. Then when they've done their day's work, they get back into their car and they recognize that the car is the car. They recognize that the stick shift is not the brake and the brake is not the stick shift. In other words, they recognize reality enough to drive home, enough to perhaps love their wife, enough to et cetera, et cetera. In other words, whenever they're leading their normal lives, they recognize reality. But whenever they're setting up their systems, they deny reality. They choose when to and when not to submit to reality. But in their essential thinking, they're setting themselves up as the kings of reality.
And does this rotting of the foundations of philosophy then affect the theology?
Absolutely, because theology is filtered for men, it filters through a human mind. So if the human mind is filled with a wrong system, then the theology comes through that wrong system, and therefore the theology will be corrupted as well. For instance, God is the creator of man, but man is king, therefore God is the creator of his king, and God becomes the subject of the king. So that's God is the creator of man, theology. Man is king, philosophy. Combination, theological conclusion, God has man for his king. You put together the good theology with the bad philosophy, and out you'll get bad theology. And that's the problem of modernism and of these modern philosophies in the heads of Catholics. It makes an absolute nonsense of their faith, because the faith has to come through their corrupted heads.
Now, I'd like to return to the subject of Pope John Paul II. He's been called an existentialist, and he's been called a phenomenologist. What do all these terms mean?
Very simply, an existentialist is somebody who is tired of all of the conflicting systems of thought, the conflicting philosophies in the modern world, which is being torn to pieces for 300 or 400 years by different systems of thought. He's tired of it, and he says, let's get away from all of these essences and let's just get back to existence. In other words, sort of reality. But at the same time that your existentialist tries to get back to existence, in other words, to what exists, at the same time he's kicking out all systems of thinking, and therefore he kicks out the truth with the falsehood, and he pretends to be just staying with reality, but in fact it's his own choice, and a very stunted choice of reality. And therefore the existentialists haven't got the answers either. They've got a very poor and limited
and I would say self-satisfied system which doesn't really explain very much at all. That's existentialism. But it is a modern system. It arose especially after the Second World War when so much was in ruins, and the thinkers said, the world is in ruins, so all previous thinking is in ruins, so let's just get back to And that's existentialism. A kind of grunt like the existentialist actors like Marlon Brando and so on. It's sort of philosophical grunting. In other words, reality man, reality. But actually they miss out on the very, very great part of reality. That's existentialism, very briefly. Phenomenalism comes directly from Kant. And that is the principle that phenomena in Greek means the appearances or things appearing. And the principle is, behind the appearances, I don't know actually what goes on. In other words, this thing I have in my hand looks like a piece of bread. It appears like a piece of bread. It may taste like a piece of bread. It may, if I bump it on the table, sound like a piece of bread. It may smell like a piece of bread. But I don't really know if it is a piece of bread. In other words, what is doesn't necessarily correspond with what appears. And all I know is what appears. Therefore, I lose my grip on what is.
So then, is part of the problem with the present Pope that he has bought into at least some of this modern subjective philosophy?
Emphatically. He was a student, an enthusiastic student of these false modern systems, especially existentialism and what's called personalism. Personalism is like existentialism. All of the systems are crazy. All that matters is the human person. All we've got left, all that's still standing after the Second World War is the person. And the person is sacred and the person is wonderful. Again, you've got the idea of man at the center of things, the human person, the sanctity, the dignity, the wonderfulness of the human person. It's a very inadequate philosophy because the human person is a mixture of good and evil, good created by God and evil flowing in cascades from his original sin. Therefore, the person is not only a creature of God, he's also a victim of original sin and a perpetrator of sin. Therefore, the person is not as sacrosanct as the personalists think. He's an existentialist and a personalist and a phenomenologist. So he accepts these modern systems, and yet at the same time he thinks that he accepts Thomism. But nobody who accepts these systems can possibly accept Thomism. Because you cannot say reality is king, and then at the same time say that man is king. They can't both be king. Either reality is king of my ideas, or my ideas are king of reality. But they can't both be true. So if you are a Thomist, then all of these modern systems are ruled right out of court. They may say something true here, they may say something true there. But they're all basically nonsense. I hate to mince words. I don't want to mince words. But they're all basically nonsense. And Thomism is the Catholic way of thinking, because there's only one reality out there, and therefore there's only one way of thinking about it which corresponds to that reality in the broad lines. Of course, you can investigate a new thing here, you can investigate a new thing there. But all truth will fit with Thomism. All truth in philosophy will fit with Thomism. And no error will fit with Thomism. And all of the modern systems, more or less, don't fit with Thomism. So the idea that you can combine any or a few of the modern systems with Thomism is nonsense.
Well, there seems to be a common thread emerging. And just let me go on a little bit. The area which has disappointed traditional Catholics about this present pontiff, the area that more traditional Catholics are concerned with than anything else about this Pope is his policy of ecumenism. Has the errors in his philosophy partly led to his ecumenical policies?
Yes. The existentialism. All the systems are ruined. Let's get back to existence, existing men. Personalism, existing men, all existing men. There's no difference between this existing man and that existing man. The systems, the beliefs, the dogmas, the doctrines that divide them are all more or less ruined. That's the sort of idea of existentialism, including implicitly the Catholic faith, because it persecuted the Jews, because it's failed to stop the terrors in the modern world, because it's etc. So all the systems are no good. Let's get back to existing man, which is everybody. That's a first step towards ecumenism. Personalism, the sacrosanctness of the human person. Whether the human person is a Buddhist or a communist or an atheist or an animist or a Jew or a Protestant or a Catholic, he's still a person. The human person is sacrosanct. Therefore, let's get all the human persons together. There's nothing much better about the Catholic person than any other person. What matters in anybody is that he is a person rather than that he is a Catholic or that he has these beliefs or those beliefs. So again, personalism, that philosophy leads directly to ecumenism.
So this very subjective, man-centered philosophy then has led to the very subjective, man-centered policy of ecumenism.
I would say so.
Now, I'd like to look...
It all goes together, yes, definitely.
I'd like to take a look then at some of the events that have characterized this policy of ecumenism. And during a trip to India, the Pope received the mark of Shiva from a Hindu priestess.
Yes.
Has the Pope participated in pagan rites by doing that?
Outwardly, definitely. Definitely. But of course, the way he sees it, I mean, the way to hell is paved with good intentions, says the old proverb. And he surely, you know, surely he had good intentions. I mean, he was wanting to reach out to all of these Indians. He was wanting to show them that they are human persons, that they are not necessarily on the road to damnation, that they are worthy of respect, they must be respected in their religion, that their religion is worthy of consideration. I mean, you can list, there could be a litany of his good intentions, but the fact of the matter is that he made this gesture, along with similar gestures in many other false and pagan religions, whereby, according to those religions themselves, he has taken part. Yes, definitely.
Now, how does that attitude compare with that of the martyrs of the early church?
The martyrs of the early church absolutely refused to have anything to do with these false religions. A 13-year-old girl would be asked to sacrifice a few grains of incense to one of the pagan gods or to the emperor, and she would say, no, I can't. But we will torture you if you don't. Well, I'm sorry, you must torture me. I will find you, will make you the, will make you, will marry the richest young man in Rome if you do. I'm sorry, he may be a very good-looking young man, but he's not, that's not, I can't do it. I just can't do it. I cannot participate in any way in a false religion. There's only one true religion and one true Savior, and he is Lord Jesus Christ. And I rely upon him to look after me and to save me, and if you want to kill me, that's your affair.
So then there is a break with tradition in this Pope's policy of ecumenism.
If he had done any of these things as a bishop 50 years ago, or 50 years before he did them, he would have been excommunicated. He would have been stripped of being a bishop. He would have been called in by Rome. He would have either had to apologize absolutely for what he was doing and promise never to do it again, or he would have been stripped of being a bishop. He would have lost his job immediately. But that's the difference. That's what happened at the Second Vatican Council. Suddenly at Vatican II, black became white and white became black.
Stop right here. Are there problems in the documents with the decree on ecumenism?
Yes, there are. The most notorious sentence is something like, the Holy Ghost makes use of all religions. There's an expression like that which is very ambiguous. You can just pull it back onto the high ground and give it a Catholic sense. But it's very easy to let it slide downhill into the mud pool at the bottom, and it's an expression which easily leads to error. That's the least you can say. And there are several such expressions in that document. The document on ecumenism is very bad, and the error is in the document itself, or the phrases highly conducive to error, that's the least you can say, are in the document itself.
Now, I've mentioned the event in India, and there's been others as well. What do events like this do to, let's say, good missionaries still working in places like India and Africa?
Oh, the missionaries are completely discouraged. I was in Sri Lanka in September, and the society has two priests there, two French priests, and they were telling me they know some of these older missionary priests, and the poor men are completely discouraged. There's no longer any reason to be a missionary. If all religions are good, then why make people into Catholics? All that you do is, logically, all you have to do is encourage people to be good in, or to really practice, really believe in, really follow whatever religion they're in. But logically, ultimately, there's not even a reason to do that. But in any case, that's what comes down from Rome, that they have no real purpose for existing any longer, and they're very discouraged men. In the old days, the church sent out hundreds of thousands, surely hundreds of thousands of missionaries, brave men willing to give their lives to carry the truth of the gospel to souls that would otherwise be damned, because they'd be living in mortal sin. For instance, in Africa, the Archbishop always used to say how when the missionaries arrived in a particular place, they would always find that the natives were heavy into the sin of hating one another, mortal hatred of one another. Then came the church, the missionaries, the gospel, the church, and those things disappeared. The natives, the Africans, came into the state of grace and were definitely at that point able to save their souls. Now, once again, the missionaries are disappearing, the church is disappearing, paganism is coming back, the witch doctors are coming back, the hatred is coming back, the mortal sin is coming back, and very few people are going to save their souls. But it's no longer the Catholic missions that will put an end to that.
Well, you see in Africa right now, by just picking up a newspaper, how these tribal wars and rivalries are beginning to revive.
Of course. And the influence of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is being virtually paralyzed from within. It's not the dear Africans who've told the missionaries to stop telling the truth. It's Rome that told the missionaries to stop telling the truth, which is that outside the Catholic Church, with very few exceptions, you can't be saved. And the few exceptions are people who would completely belong to the Church if they really knew, but they're not. Everything indicates that there are not. God knows how many those exceptions are, but there's certainly not many.
So one of the problems with ecumenism then is that maybe the ideal is to reach out to our separated brethren, but the impact then is that it doesn't accomplish that, plus it demoralizes your own people.
That's what happens, because the new kind of ecumenism doesn't believe in the truth. It just believes in getting together. But you've not got any truth, any saving truth to make sure that the boy goes out of the house in the direction where the car really is, so that he can then drive downtown. You're telling people that the road to heaven is everywhere where it isn't and not where it is.
Now, the height of this policy of ecumenism, or at least so far the worst example, seems to be the meeting in Assisi. Very briefly, what was this meeting, and how did Archbishop Lefebvre react to it?
The meeting at Assisi you're referring to happened in October of 1986, when, at Pope John Paul II's invitation, representatives of all religions, all the main religions of the world, met together on an equal footing. They met in order to be together, in order to pray. I think he said, we're not praying together, but we are together in order to pray. Which is a subtle distinction by which he tried to escape from the accusation that they were praying together. In other words, that error and truth were mixing together in order to pray. That he wanted to avoid, so he said, what we're doing is we're all meeting together in order to pray separately. I think that was the idea. But that's... The Archbishop said, this recognition of false, this positive invitation and recognition of false religions, of the representatives of false religions as representatives of false religions by the Vicar of Christ, is an unheard of scandal. The Archbishop was scandalized out of his mind, and also the Archbishop was scandalized at the lack of reaction on the part of Catholics. The Archbishop was astonished that so many Catholics were not scandalized, that so many Catholics were sort of accepting this modern way of thinking whereby it doesn't matter so much what you believe. In other words, beliefs are not that important. The downgrading of doctrine and dogma with which we started the first tape. And he did what he could in order to set the record straight. And I think that event at Assisi was one of the things that decided the Archbishop to consecrate four bishops in 1988. To make sure that tradition would be able to keep going on its own, because if this was where the Vicar of Christ was thinking, there's very little hope that the bishops under him would know how to look after the Catholic faith. And so he He made sure that there would be some bishops for, let's say, old-fashioned Catholics, for traditional Catholics, to help them to keep the faith.
What does it do to the faithful when they see these meetings of, let's say, 15 different religions and their various leaders all lined up in a row and they're all together basically as one?
If they saw all these leaders together without the Pope, Catholics would say, well, you know, okay, that's a whole bunch of errors and they're all errors mixing together and congratulating one another. But when they see the Holy Father, the Vicar of Christ, in amongst them, then they're bound to say, well, then there isn't so much difference between truth and error.
So can it lead to indifferentism then?
Absolutely. Because what religion, doesn't matter what religion, it's indifferent which religion we belong to. Truth doesn't matter so much. All that matters is getting together. Once again, unity. Instead of unity in truth, it's unity above truth. Unity regardless of truth. And that's an absolute disaster. That's going to send millions of souls to hell.
And is this why, perhaps, past popes have condemned such kind of meetings?
Yes, exactly why. The Catholic Church has always held back and refused to take part, notably at the end of the last century, when such meetings were beginning, especially over here in the United States, there were one or two famous cases. And the first time, I think, the Catholics took part, but the second time, Pope Leo forbade them, because it's much too scandalous and misleading for the faithful.
Now, I'd like to then look at another aspect or another event. When the Pope went to Scandinavia, he praised Martin Luther.
But again, that's very scandalous and very misleading. Of course, Martin Luther had qualities. And of course, he said some truths. That's just like the port side of the Titanic being intact. But if there's a gash up the starboard side, the Titanic will sink. Luther said a lot of things in which he agreed with the Catholics. He still believed that Jesus Christ was God. He still believed in the existence of God. But he did not believe in the Catholic Church. He thought the Catholic Church was the prostitute of Rome and so on. And therefore, there was a huge gash in the starboard side, and enough to sink the Catholic Church in half of Europe.
What did Luther say about the papacy?
He was scathing about the papacy, the Babylon, the church in Babylonian captivity. Every insult in the book he flung at the Pope. He hated and loathed the Pope in Rome and pretended that the Pope was the cause of all the problems of Christendom and did everything he could to destroy the papacy.
Well, isn't then the Pope undermining his own position then by praising Martin Luther?
Of course he is. Of course he is. But this poor Pope is confused. He believes in one set of principles, and then at the same time he believes just as much in an opposite set of principles. He believes in the modern ideas and he believes in the anti-modern ideas, and I think he really does believe in both, and he's not intelligent enough to realize that these two systems contradict one another.
Well, then was perhaps Archbishop Lefebvre trying to save the Pope from himself in some of these, let's say, criticisms of the ecumenical policy that he made?
Absolutely. The Archbishop used to say that he was the Pope's best friend because he's saving that for which the Pope is Pope, the very essence of the papacy Archbishop Lefebvre was protecting. Therefore, he was the Pope's best friend. The Pope, of course, couldn't see it. The Pope Paul VI is meant to have died saying that the great problem of his reign had been Archbishop Lefebvre. Meaning by that if only Archbishop Lefebvre had not been raining on his parade, as Americans say, then everything would have been wonderful in his papacy. Of course, it's completely false, but it's perfectly possible that that is the way Pope Paul VI thought. And it's very possibly the way that Pope John Paul II thinks as well. Everybody else approves him. Everybody else claps. He's popular with everybody else, but not with these wretched Lefebvreists. If only the Lefebvreists would accept, then everybody would all be happy. We would all be happy together in one huge party. We would all be united. We would all have unity. There would be love. There would be peace. That's the vision of John Paul II.
Now, could an analogy be, let's say, the son who criticizes his father for going out and getting drunk, that this son may be trying very hard to save the father from himself, but the father doesn't see it that way?
Yes, that's a comparison which fits. The father doesn't like being told by his son what to do and what not to do, especially when the father wants to get drunk. And so the father resents being told by his son not to get drunk, but the son is still absolutely right. And the son is protecting the authority and the honor of his father. He's protecting that for which the father is father. If the father goes on behaving like that, the father is going to destroy his fatherhood. Eventually get thrown into jail without his children or whatever, far from his children. The son, the older son who tries to stop him drinking, is this son, his father's best friend. But the father doesn't see it that way.
Now, I think most of us would agree that the son would be in his total rights to make this objection to his father. But is it acceptable for this kind of rebuke or resistance to authority to go on within the church? Are there circumstances when someone can rebuke or resist the authority of a superior in the church?
Yes, because faith is greater than obedience. Obedience is not the servant of obedience, says a Spanish proverb. Obedience is the servant of the faith, because with the faith I will get to heaven. And if I obey something which is not the faith, I will, with the best of intentions perhaps, but still, go to hell. Therefore, the faith takes the front rank, and obedience is to serve the faith. If, therefore, those people who bring me the faith are stepping aside from the faith, I'm not obliged to obey them insofar as they step aside from the faith. That was what Paul did when he rebuked Peter, as we learn in the Epistle of the Galatians.
So there are examples from church history where saints have done that.
Very clearly. More than one. But the classic example is in Scripture itself. It's in the second epistle to the Galatians, of St. Paul to the Galatians, and where St. Paul describes how he stood up to Peter because Peter was misleading the faithful and risked doing grave damage to the faith and to the church. And Paul stood up to him, and Paul was quite right. It was too grave for him to keep quiet. Normally, of course, you acknowledge authority, you respect authority. Catholics are, as Catholics, always very respectful. But if it's a question of the very destruction of the faith and destruction of the church, then Catholics must speak up, whatever rank they are.
Now, however, whenever the Pope takes part in an ecumenical event or carries out some liberal action, you always have, from some conservative-minded Catholics, all kinds of excuses emerge trying to defend the Pope, and they'll criticize anyone who does take the step of rebuking the Pope or resisting his authority. Why is this?
Because these conservative Catholics have got the mind habits still of Catholics of the 1950s. Now, Catholics in the 1950s had for tens of years or even hundreds of years popes who kept to the truth, down to and including Pope Pius XII. And therefore, these conservative Catholics assume, and Michael Davis is one of them, that John the 23rd and Paul the 6th and John Paul the 1st and John Paul the 2nd, they assume that these are popes just like Pius the 12th, and therefore we can trust most things, if not practically all, that they say, and even to utter the slightest criticism is out of place and it's un-Catholic. But that's not true at all. The times have changed. By permission of God, we no longer have popes like Pope Pius the 12th or Pope Pius the 11th or Pope Pius the 10th, let's say. Although even they were still men, even Pope St. Pius X was still a man, and he wasn't infallible or impeccable outside of his solemn declarations. But there was a great change from John the 23rd onwards. The modern world said to God, "We don't want any more of your popes, we want popes our way." And so the Lord God said, "All right, you have popes your way and see how you like it. I'll give you your kind of pope instead of my kind of pope," and that was John the 23rd instead of Pius the 12th. And therefore, what these conservative Catholics have not yet woken up to is that we've got a very different situation in the official church, and it's about time they woke up and realized that you cannot trust dear Pope John Paul II like you could trust Pius the 12th.
And now, also, if you take a longer view of history, in the Middle Ages, it was much more common to rebuke a pope.
Exactly. That's very true. Because in the Middle Ages, Catholics were much more robust. The faith came first, and everybody knew what the faith was, and everybody knew what the church was. And that could be taken for granted. But from the time of the Counter-Reformation onwards, that with the arrival of Protestantism, that situation changed, and Catholics sort of stuck to their leaders, and the leaders stuck to the flock much more, because now there was a common enemy all around them of Protestants. And so there was a much greater cleaving to authority, let's say, and you don't criticize the Catholic Pope because that's going to do the work of the Protestants. You could no longer, from the Counter-Reformation onwards, Catholics could no longer afford to criticize the Pope as freely as they had done before, because the enemy were all around. And therefore a habit grew up of not criticizing the Pope. And in fact, many of the popes for these 400 years did not deserve that much criticism in a certain sense. They were good. And that's why Catholics for the last 40 years have been so completely unhorsed so many Catholics have been unhorsed by the fact that popes are not good popes. The Catholics just aren't prepared for it. I think they're slowly, slowly waking up. Some conservative Catholics are waking up all the time. But by no means all of them are still woken up, and a number of them still have those Pius XII habits. The Pope, the Pope, the Pope, don't you dare criticize, don't you dare criticize, don't you dare criticize. You must be Catholic, you must be Catholic, you must be Catholic. Hey, they've got to wake up. We're in a very different situation.
Now, was there not, earlier this century, a French seminary professor who said that a serious error that was developing within the Church was a tendency to exaggerate the authority and infallibility of the Pope?
That was the rector of the French seminary in Rome, Le Père Le Floch, Father Le Floch. And he said, yes, I think he said at about the time of 1926, the condemnation of Action Française, which he knew was basically a mistake. And it was done by the Pope, by Pope Pius XI, who normally passes for being, you know, a very good Pope. But that was a great mistake of his, I think, almost certainly. And Père Le Floch saw it, and Père Le Floch said, there's a danger that we... And he saw, Père Le Floch saw a lot of Catholics accepting this papal error simply because the error came from the Pope. And Père Le Floch was saying, watch out, everybody. People must not say that everything that the Pope says is true and everything that he condemns is error, because that's not true. And if we go on like this, we're going to get into real trouble. That's what Father Le Floch was saying. And I think he was absolutely right.
Now, could you, for our listeners, define where the Pope is infallible and where he is not?
Infallibility is ordinary or extraordinary. The extraordinary infallibility is when he speaks ex cathedra, in other words, with four conditions. He's got to speak as Pope on a matter of faith or doctrine or morals, with the intention to bind the whole Church, and in definitive fashion. In other words, he's got to say, this is it. This is how it is. I am speaking as Pope. You must believe it. And this is a question of doctrine and morals. If he does that, with or without a special ceremony, the ceremony is not what counts, but those four points, if he does it, then he is guaranteed by the Holy Ghost protection from any error. He may not say something specially wise or specially true, but it will be whatever he says under those conditions will be protected from error. That's the extraordinary infallibility, or the solemn magisterium, as it's sometimes called. Besides that is the ordinary infallibility, which is when either the Pope or a cardinal or a bishop or a priest or even a layman or even an eight-year-old child, a Catholic child, says something that the Church has always said. For instance, the wrongness of artificial means of birth control. That's the Church has always said that. The Church has never solemnly defined that, but she's always said it. It's part of the ordinary infallible magisterium. It's never been defined. It could be defined. It hasn't been defined. But since the Church has always said it, it's bound to be true because the Church has always said it. Therefore, you have your extraordinary and your ordinary magisterium. The extraordinary is clearest because then there's some definition. The ordinary, you simply have to go by the Church has always said. And for that, you have to look up what the doctors and the theologians and the teachers down all the ages have said.
Now, another area, aside from ecumenism, that has disappointed many traditional Catholics is that of John Paul II's governance. They say that he's not governing the Church because he's not cracking down on, let's say, heretical or dissident theologians who are going against the faith. Is that perhaps weakness of governance? Is that similar or some way consistent with the policy of ecumenism?
Yes, because he doesn't believe, he no longer believes that the truth is as important as the old popes used to believe it is, and of course as it is. Therefore, whereas the old popes used to take the truth, the Catholic truth, very seriously, and they put the Catholic truth right up front, and even at the expense of unity, I mean, even at the expense of losing, like our Lord in the synagogue of Capernaum, the popes would tell the truth, and if those who had been up till then Catholics didn't like it, and they wanted to walk away, then the popes let them walk away, just like half of Europe walked away as Protestants at the time of the Protestant Reformation. The popes didn't say, look, you guys, we're going to change the truth, come back. No, the Pope said, this is the Catholic truth, and if anyone who doesn't like it had better move away from the Catholic Church, which is exactly what happened. And the Catholic Church lost half of Europe, so to speak. But in the modern case, these recent popes don't believe in the truth being as important as that. They believe that unity is as valuable as truth. Not unity in the truth, but unity in front of truth. Therefore, they don't believe in condemning error. If they don't believe in truth, if they don't believe truth is so important, they don't believe error is so important. If they don't believe error is so important, they won't believe in condemning error. They will do anything rather than condemn people that they're wanting to draw into unity.
So it's the same error that underpins the policy of ecumenism, and at the same time, a weakness in governance.
Yes, another factor in the weakness of government. And I do believe you're right, that he does not govern the church as he should. Malachi Martin says the same thing. He believes in democracy. He does not believe... he believes that his fellow bishops are like his equal. Now, of course, he's contradictory, so there are moments by which he does tell his fellow bishops what to do or what to think. But then there are other moments in which he tells them, you are my equals, I am your equal, and you know... it's all of us together.
So this is called collegiality,
yes,
usually, isn't it?
Yes, that's collegiality, is one of the great principles of Vatican II, and it's another destroyer of the Church. And in the name of the College of Bishops, in other words, all of us bishops getting together as a group, as a college, the papacy is undone. So he does not believe in telling his fellow bishops what to do. He believes in pleading, he believes in suggesting, he believes in inviting, but he does not believe in commanding. If you don't believe in commanding, it becomes difficult to command.
But there is a contradiction here, because both Paul VI and John Paul II have had a policy of ecumenism, and at the same time... tolerating various dissidents within the church, yet when it came to Archbishop Lefebvre, they were very, very severe.
It's the old liberal principle. They are liberals, and they believe in the liberal principle, liberty for all except for the enemies of liberty. What makes Archbishop Lefebvre and those who accompany him or follow him different from all of the other errors is that all of the errors, if you like, accept that the truth doesn't matter. But Archbishop Lefebvre and those who think like him say the truth does matter. And therefore all of those who are in error are in error, and they are to be condemned. But those who are in error of one kind or another are much less inclined to condemn one another. And they're much less inclined to value the truth. They don't see the truth. They don't see the importance of the truth. They don't see what the truth says. And therefore it is in that way consistent for people in error to say, okay, let's all be in error, but the one kind of person that we can't stand is those who insist upon a truth which condemns our error. Those are not acceptable. We all of us who are in error, we can all happily mix together, but anybody who dares come along and say that he has the truth and that all of us are in error, he's unacceptable. We can't have him in the party. He reigns on our parade.
So there is a consistency here with what happened in the days of the Roman Empire, where the Romans would accept basically every religion except the Christians, because the Christians were the only ones that wouldn't offer sacrifices to the emperor and their gods.
The Roman Empire began by accepting even Christianity in those first few tens of years when Christianity arrived in Rome. But when the Roman Empire realized that the Christians were condemning every false belief of every other false belief in Rome, and that they were pretending to be the only ones that had the truth, that's the moment when the Roman Empire came down on the Christians.
So there is also a parallel here with Archbishop Lefebvre, because Lefebvre was tolerated the first 5 years of his existence after he started the Society St. Pius X. When it was when they realized that he was doing more than carrying on tradition, he was also criticizing the errors of modernism, then they came down with a sledgehammer.
Yes, exactly. Because he condemns their whole system. He condemns the very basis of their system. He attacks the very heart, the root and heart of liberalism. Liberals understandably can't take that. I mean, the Jews don't attack the very heart of liberalism. The Mohammedans don't attack it. You know, the various people don't attack it in the way that Archbishop Lefebvre attacks it. And therefore, all of those others are acceptable. But the man who says, you are all of you in error, in basic and radical error, he's not acceptable. No, of course he isn't.
Right now, there's this getting together of the various religions of the world, or they're strengthening the relations. Do you think that all this could eventually lead to a one-world religion, or at least a one-world religion system?
That's certainly what it's meant to lead to. The powers that be behind the modern world are certainly, especially Freemasonry in particular, and Judaism, what the French writers of the beginning of this century used to call Judeo-Masonry. In other words, those Jews who work with the Freemasons and those Freemasons who work with the Jews. That doesn't mean all Freemasons, it doesn't mean all Jews, but it means those Gentiles or Jews who are working together behind the scenes in order to get rid of Christianity and replace it with a brand new system. They know that they need a religion to control human beings and make the human beings fit into their Antichrist system. And so they're going to need all of the structures and as many of the people as possible of the great Roman Catholic Church. They want to build into their system in order to provide their system with a religious dimension and a religious justification. And that's, therefore, the powers that be, the Judeo-Masons behind the modern world, are definitely inside the Vatican promoting this the movement towards a one-world religion. In other words, the blending of all religions together with, as a figurehead, the supposed Vicar of Christ in Rome.
And the Pope could be, wittingly or unwittingly, then an instrument of those people.
I think, personally, that he is an unwitting instrument. I think he means well. I think he is quite deliberately acting to bring together all religions, but I don't think he realizes that he's playing the game of the Antichrist. I think he's sincerely mistaken that this is what Christ wants. I think he's sincerely mistaken. I think he's sincere. I'm not saying he's free of grave fault. God is judge. He ought to know better, and undoubtedly he's all the time receiving the grace to know better. But he must be pushing that grace away because he's wanting to push through his idea of what the church should be like. But I think that he does believe that his idea of what the church should be like is Jesus Christ's idea. It isn't, of course, but I think that's what he thinks.
Now, in the year 2000, there is a meeting planned for Mount Sinai. Just exactly what is this meeting? And perhaps does it have some Antichrist implications?
It's a plan for the three main monotheistic religions, as they're called, the three main religions that believe in one God, Judaism, Mohammedanism, and Christianity. It's a plan for representatives of these three religions to meet on Mount Sinai for a celebration on Mount Sinai, Mount Sinai being the great location of Moses. And they are hoping that by this meeting of the three great religions, it would be a major step forward for the blending of the union of men, the unifying of mankind, and this will suitably solemnize the arrival of the third millennium in the year 2000. It will certainly downgrade the truth, because Catholic truth contradicts Mohammedan error, it contradicts Jewish error. The Jews don't believe in the Holy Trinity, for instance. They deny the Holy Trinity. They deny that Jesus Christ is God. The Mohammedans likewise. Therefore, these religions basically clash with one another, and to bring them together in a meeting is to push into the background all of those Catholic truths which these errors deny, And therefore, it's going to be to downgrade essential Catholic truths. It's bound to downgrade Jesus Christ, which is bound to be a major step forward for the Antichrist.
Now, you have another third leg of this policy, which could be called a policy of weakness. One is the lack of governance. One is the policy of ecumenism. Lately, there's been a rash of apologies coming from the Pope to the world. How would you view this? Do you think that is kind of looking at the whole situation holistically, part of a policy of weakness?
I don't think it's a policy of weakness. I don't think he's doing it because he's obliged to by weakness to do it.
Maybe for our listeners, we should describe like what some of these apologies have been.
Well, what are you thinking of especially?
Well, let's say when he apologizes for how the church has treated women, when he apologizes
that Galileo.
Yes.
And then the question of the Jews and so on. These apologies are a disaster because the Catholic Church hasn't been wrong on these questions. When the Catholic Church has seriously and thoughtfully in centuries past taken position on these questions, the Catholic Church knew what she was doing. And it's a grave lack of respect for his predecessors to pretend that they were wrong and that they didn't know what they were doing. The church had very good reason for saying about Galileo what she said and so on. And Galileo was more wrong than he was right. Similarly on other questions on other politically correct, quote-unquote, questions of today, the church was right and the, quote-unquote, politically correct position of today is wrong, quite simply. Truth doesn't change from one century to the next. And therefore, the Pope is undermining the respect for the Catholic Church of the past, and he's building a very weak basis. He's undermining his own authority in the present. If the popes were all so dumb in the past, as he's now saying, why isn't he also dumb in the present? Why should anybody take him seriously if all his predecessors were so foolish as he's saying? It's insanity.
Now, why is it that the modern church seems to have no defenses?
Because it doesn't want to defend, because it's got nothing to defend. All it wants is to reach out and hug and kiss and be friends and love, and it just wants to build a gigantic love party. It's got nothing to defend.
So is there an attempt then to reconcile the church with the world then? Is that ultimately the problem?
Yes.
And it's downplayed doctrine in order to do so.
Well, we come back to the beginning where the essence of Pope John Paul's thinking is to combine, is to blend Catholicism with existentialism, personalism, and phenomenism. And in other words, blend the Catholic tradition with the modern systems to fit the church to the world and fit the world to the church. And that's what he really thinks he's doing.
And can that work?
No, it can't. It cannot. It's bound to come apart. You can't mix oil and water. You can't mix truth and error. There is such a thing as truth. The massive problem today is that he, like millions of Catholics, like even more millions of human beings, has lost all sense of a truth which excludes error. Dante has a marvelous line in the Divine Comedy, and he describes the people drifting around in hell as those that have lost the good of the intellect, meaning the good of the intellect, what the intellect is good for, is the truth. Those that have lost the truth, he said. And the people, the masses of people drifting around today, that's exactly it. The people that have lost the truth.
They don't have a compass.
They don't. Their minds don't have a compass. Their minds are adrift. They've got mind rot, which just lifts their mind off its basis, off its roots, and their minds are just drifting. And Pope John Paul II's mind is adrift.
And if we want to read, let's say, books to look into the issue of John Paul II's thinking and actions, what would you recommend?
Firstly, I would always say the writings of Archbishop Lefebvre. Archbishop Lefebvre never spoke in great detail about the Pope's philosophy, but he is the best on the subject. Also very good in English is Abbé Daniel Leroux, Peter Lovest Thou Me. Also very good, if you can understand, are the two books of Professor Derman, which have been translated so far, on the theological journey of Pope John Paul II to Assisi.
Thank you, Bishop Williamson.